Dude, Benton Guinness, Sir Bentonius of House Guinness. Dude, I'm so excited to talk to you. I can't. I'm on the edge of my seat and my heart is a flutter because as I always try to start these episodes off with some context, you were one of these people. I recently had Ellie Barone on and it was a similar experience only because I love her so much and we worked together at school. The three of us actually worked on a project that is still one of my favorite things ever. And I haven't seen her and I didn't know anything. And I've seen you so very much from a distance, but like, you know, nonsense, social media, nothing. I don't know anything about what's going on with you. And so I saw you in December, but it was at an alumni event where the fucking, God bless them, Bandits on the Run were playing at full volume. And so it was like, yeah, bro. Oh my God. High five. See you later. All right. You know that, like, yeah. The bar, what's up? So yeah, we didn't get any conversation.
So many people to see at the holiday party. It was so good to see you though, you know?
It was great. And I've never been to that party before. And so for me, it was like a first time at that thing, but also first time seeing so, so many people, definitely since pandemic, but other people. I mean, I saw people I hadn't seen since I graduated. It's been a minute. So I'm excited to catch up with you, man. But I'm going to start, as I always do, with where are you from?
I'm from Ellsbury, Missouri.
That sounds like a huge city. Is that right?
Yeah, you probably have heard about it in, you know, Times.
And everybody's from there.
Yeah, it's like a lot of, yeah, you know, it produces, you know, great actors, you know.
One after the other, Tom Cruise, John Travolta, yeah. Martin Landau.
Missouri, though, for real. Brad Pitt.
That's true. Is he from like, he's from like St. Louis, right?
I think he just went to college there. You know, I'm not exactly sure. I just kind of thought
this is less fun. This is about you. Tell me about Ellsbury.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes. Population, I think like 900, something like that.
Dude, that is a small town.
Yeah. Don't fact check me, but it's tiny.
Yeah. Are you on like a, are you on like a farm or is it like just a small town or is it a very,
yeah, rural? No, I grew up on a cattle farm in Ellsbury. It's, my dad is a farmer lawyer.
Farmer lawyer? That's an interesting combination.
Yeah. He moved from the Bronx to go get land. You know, my dad was always really poor. And they started a family with my mom, and so he's like pretty Bronx, and he moved out to this population 900 farm town.
It's like Green Acres except without the money.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
that show? It's like way from before both of our times, but like the Manhattan couples, like wealthy, and they decide to move to the farm, and just that clashing of culture is so intense. They built an entire number one sitcom out of it, and your dad's living it.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Is like, mom from Bronx too?
She's from Jersey.
Okay. So the area. They met there.
Yeah, they went to school together, like high school sweetheart situation. My dad, I think, moved out to New Jersey for a little while and they met and fell in love, et cetera, et cetera. She, that's kind of actually inverse. She's from like nine brothers and sisters and they grew up on a racehorse farm. Jersey.
Okay. Like,
he was like a, you know, very nice horse farmer. My grandpa.
Your mom's dad?
Yeah.
Got it. Horse farmer with a lot of kids.
Yeah, nine. Crazy.
Did he race them like in the backyard? That's what I would do if it was my field, you know? I would get all the kids, I would pick a favorite, and then I would let the neighbors take bets on who the fastest kid was.
I think you'd have a fantastic farming operation, Rob. I think you made
either that or it's a great testament to why I should never have any children. I immediately was like, let's make some money off these fuckers, you know?
Super small town. I love Ellsbury so much though. We've got the Senate Theater, a little local movie theater. Mr. Senate, who owns it, he comes out before each movie and you know, gives his thoughts. And
it really is like one of those, like, I can't remember the town in Gilmore Girls, but there's some TV shows that just have that. And you're like, yeah, that's the baker. That's the mayor. Like, he's, you know,
it's a little bit like if you go to your friend's like new play they just wrote and they're from Missouri and they're like, they're like, oh, like here on these streets and these farms.
Right.
Why? You know, like
right. Yeah, streets, like, roads, let's be honest.
Yeah. There's one road.
road out on these mean road.
Yeah. There's like the road kind of L and. Me and my friends, we drink beer and ride around in a truck. It's called Cruising the L. You know, you just go around in a circle and
Jesus.
Elkberry.
Do you, are you close to like a, what's the closest big city that you're going into to do bigger things?
St. Louis, I guess, hour and a half.
And how often are you going to St. Louis as a kid?
Not that much, honestly.
Really?
Like as a kid, I remained pretty much running around naked on a cattle farm.
That's interesting that your parents didn't like have that draw, like, oh, we gotta make sure we take the kids to the city shit. You know, we grew up with the city shit. We see the value in that. They were like, let's keep them out here on the farm. They got enough.
I mean, they did. An hour and a half drive to the city with your kids, like, you know, I guess
for sure.
But we go to like St. Louis has like the City Museum. It's amazing. Yeah. Have you heard of this place?
I've never been there, but I've been to St. Louis. I've never been to that place, but there's a lot of stuff in St. Louis.
We go get Ted Drew's. We go to the Fox Theater sometimes, you know,
that's good. So you're getting that exposure to some culture that's not on the TV is kind of what I'm getting at. Cause when you're a kid, there's only two versions of how, or three versions really of how you get culture, right? There's your friends and family. There's the TV. And then there's everything else that just happens to be around you. And you grow up in big city, there's just stuff, you know, you walk down the streets of Manhattan as a child and you're like, wow, this Broadway show's yelling at me, even if no one's talking about it, this thing's happening. But when you're out on the farm, cause I grew up, I don't know if we've really talked about this, but you know, I grew up like half the time on a cattle farm too in Texas. Yeah. And so it's like, when you're spending that time out there, you're learning a lot of different things. It's not about exposure to culture as much as it is to exposure to like skill sets, exposure to like how things work, how to do things
to yourself too.
Yeah.
You know, I have a really strong, I think, connection to myself because, you know, my perspective was made just sort of like me and a cow out in the field sometimes.
It's quiet. Well, we're going to jump ahead in a minute and talk about you living in fucking New York City, which is not out in the country at all. Yeah. But you had a kind of smooth transition then when you think about it. So you stayed in Missouri until you graduated high school. You were doing you're doing plays and stuff like that in high school, right?
And Duchenne High.
How do you end up like on the track to be at School of the Arts to do acting professionally, like out there? What is the, is it a draw to leave that environment? Cause you sound so in love with it. Or is it like, what, why leave? You sound like you were so happy in that environment. Why not like take over the farm or be the baker?
in this town,
right?
You need bakers. I just had to spread my wings and fly. No, I mean, I can actually pinpoint someone very specific, an NCSA alumni, actually, who I encountered in my life, who brought me to NCSA, basically. And to,
let's hear
to
it.
To acting in general. I mean, you know, when I was a kid, the first play I ever did, it was with my sister. She was big in the drama program at high school in the city. She went off to high school in the city, as opposed to the Ellsbury high school. And I always thought that was like fascinating, you know, she's like on another planet, basically. St. Charles, right. Like the big city, St. Charles, you know, like, let's go. And she did this play. She was sort of the lead in all of her shows, and this play needed a bunch of kids in it. And she brought me on. And I remember I just loved it, man. I loved it so much. And I had this experience where my sister was like, she told that there was this big like jock guy playing. It was like a, it was like a Holocaust play, of course, for St. Charles Catholic High School. And there was like this big jock guy who was like throwing us on a train, you know, and she told him, she was like, hey, could you like push him extra hard or something so I cry, you know? And I remember that happened. I looked at him, I looked at her, and then I had to go sit down and like draw something. And I remember I was drawing my family and I was just crying. I didn't really understand. I think I was in second grade, I think. So I like didn't really get what was going on. And I think there's a recording and like my sister just staring at me, you know, I'm this little Jewish kid. Just like that. I was great. I ever since then, I think I sort of wanted to explore, like, there's like another, there's like a different world. I couldn't really wrap my head around it, but I always wanted to do something like that. And I started getting really interested in the arts. Of course, I wanted to be a rock star, like way more. So I was doing a lot of guitar playing and like open mics and trying to do that sort of thing. And was starting to do bad in high school. Cause I just like, I'm not made for, you know, like school or math or cubicles or I don't know. I'm just,
What does that mean to you? Break that open a little bit for me. Why do you say that? Cause I'm not either, dude. I have literally bailed on school and quit a dream job in a cubicle at Comedy Central because it didn't suit me, but the show's not about me right now. So why do you feel that way?
I mean, there's so much you can go into about American school systems and how they, you know, what they're gearing people really, but
And we've talked about that on this show a lot about how it's not made, especially for the people a lot of times that end up at School of the Arts. That's part of why they end up in that curriculum, this weird new conservatory arts all day thing. What? Because they've been doing liberal arts for 13 years.
Hogwarts to me, UNCSA. Wow.
Oh, for sure. So, I mean, there's definitely that. But what did you start to feel like? I'm interested in talking about this for a couple of reasons. First of all, I also briefly went to a very rural school district when I was living out on the farm. And the school that was public there versus the school that was public in the city. Holy shit. And then I went to high school in New York City. That was a totally different experience. And so I'm curious for you as you're growing up and you said you have an older sister. How many siblings do you have total?
Catherine, Patrick, Daniel, 3.
That's an interesting way to count. So
like I said, man, I did school. It's just not my,
exactly. We're getting to this. Yes, exactly.
Not my siblings. Fuck, too hard. Right. Stop.
You're like, I almost ran out of fingers, asshole. But did you feel when, at what point in your like grade school experience were you like, I'm not feeling like the left side of my brain shit, maybe if you weren't calling it that, but I'm not feeling like that is the thing where I'm like getting patted on the back, feeling like that's something I'm getting right. When did you start to feel that trail? Because I feel like no one notices that when you're like in first or second grade, shit's kind of easy. When did it start to feel like it wasn't your vibe?
Well, I got asked, I remember by the drama teacher who, my high school drama teacher is such a gem. Yeah, I mean, that's an important, I feel like that's—
God bless high school drama teachers.
Yeah, and she's particular. I mean, we'll probably talk about her a little bit, like, wow. Yeah, she was this is a Catholic high school I went to because it's kind of the only option where I'm from. None of my family's Catholic, maybe really very religious, to be honest. But
a lot of times the Catholic school is the best school in the neighborhood.
It was, yeah. And this is an hour away from where I live anyway, long commute. But she's an ex-nun, this lady, and thought she was more into making... what's the word, like you know, dynamic and in your face art instead, you know.
Got it.
I think this is the perfect stage for me to enter, you know, and to go into this world with somebody who's like, let's make this, like, let's go raw, you know, it's like,
yeah, stuff. For sure.
But she was like, hey, I think I was doing a speech class, and she just was like, you're really good, you know, join the drama club, do the play. And I was like, yeah, cool. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Fun. I, you know, and then you start to focus, you start to find that world again. And it's like, everything else kind of gets on the periphery. You know what I mean? It really does. I wasn't doing
it
so well.
It seems so small. And yeah, I think what's weird is all the adults in your life who you do respect are telling you that that shit is so important. And you just have this like naive heartbeat thing that you're like, I can't even articulate it, but you're wrong. Yeah. It's not important to me. And I'm going to be okay not being great at that shit.
I think it's, you know, there's certainly alternative lives to be explored than what you're told you can do, especially in a rural place in the education system. But
what were you told before your drama teacher who was like, you're amazing?
I mean, before I chose to go to high school in the city, the high school in my hometown is really geared towards producing farmers, firefighters.
Agriculture.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the MFA is a huge part of it. There's this, who's the like kind of the horrible like science conglomerate that does like agriculture and science, and they've done a lot.
Like Monsanto?
Yes, they come to that. When I was there, at least, they'd come regularly and preach and give out literature.
Wow. So that was the path kind of being laid out of like, hey, kid, welcome to your future at Monsanto. And let me teach you about pesticides.
If Monsanto wasn't there, the army was, you know what I mean?
Right. So that's what it felt like you were on track for before you found the theater shit. Like you found that aptitude.
Yeah. I don't think I was never going to be a farmer. It's not on my periphery, but my father's, you know, a lawyer. My oldest brother became a lawyer. And that was definitely something we always talked about. I mean, my skill set I could pinpoint from early on was just sort of like talking to people, communicating, I guess.
Right.
And I didn't know how else to filter that besides become a lawyer. That was really my plan for a while.
Being in court is so little of being a lawyer, even when you're a trial lawyer. That's the thing that sucks about watching it on TV.
Yeah, I
have to be a nerd.
Every time I call my dad, I say like something like, so like, do you find, you know, who killed him or something? You know, he's like, it's not that exciting. It's not.
Right.
But long story short, what options I had, I didn't really know. But it was starting to go to where I just didn't care about much else. And you can't really follow much of a track to like make this a career. In fact, when I grew up, certainly before high school, and I think some into high school, it didn't even occur to me that like acting is a profession, like that it's an actual job. I just thought it was like you're standing in line for some ice cream one day and somebody goes, you're hot, like come in this movie, and then you're a star.
Had that happened to you enough already for other reasons that you were like, eventually it'll be for acting? Because I'm constantly being called out of lines for how hot I am.
I mean, of course, that's happened throughout my life. And that's something else we can talk about. It's really hard. It's really hard.
How it's been uphill for you to be so handsome?
No, I wasn't, though. I wasn't. You know, I was handsome, of course. I mean,
I met you when you were like 17. And you're one of the best looking people ever. Are you like, yeah. And you look like you've aged about 25 minutes. So like,
thanks, man. Thanks. I'm in callbacks for something that's somebody who's 22 right now, and I'm really trying.
Hey man, you know, I don't got the looks, but I got the age with you, dude. 100%. Yeah, I constantly got it. People are like, what are you like, 26? And I'm like, thank you very much. Milk retinol, that for as long as I can.
Retinol, salicylic acid, lots conditioner. Let's go. Serums. Yeah. Date a black woman if you can, and you'll look much younger.
I went with Korean, but it works the same way.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Courtney.
Some of that don't crack and that don't raisin comes through.
She's got witchery on how she can preserve. She's going to be beautiful. forever. But another story. Anyways,
we'll get there.
Yeah. So I didn't really know what my direction was, but my mom, who is probably the most loving mom in the entire world, if everybody doesn't think that about their own mom, but my mom is the best. She's a local librarian at Ellsbury Public Library, and she has like a section in the library where kids write their own books, and you can check out the kids' books that they wrote. Like she's the best. And she always really cares about me, and she was kind of the one who was like, you know, he should be an artist probably. You know, my dad pretty adamant, you know, I grew up poor and my kid's not going to grow up poor. Like, get a job, please. You know what I mean? But part of my parents moving to Ellsbury in the first place and having kids was they said, we want to do things differently than like how it was done for us. And right. our goal is to not stifle these kids' creativity. Like that was their, they had a great, like it was like a parenting plan. It was so good.
Parents, and I know you're quite a bit younger than me, but not really. How old are your parents? Like what, how old are they right now?
Sorry, mom and dad. Let's say they're 40.
Oh, come on. It's going to be fine. Let's be honest.
60s. Yeah.
60s. Okay. So our parents are about the same age. Our parents, and this is a thing that I'm really learning too in talking to people from School of the Arts, especially around our age. A lot of these people we went to school with, man, they went to school with us because they had parents like us who were coming off of a certain kind of parenting and behavior that they resented. And so they were like, no. When we do it, we're going to do this. And so you and I grew up with the freedom to go, what do I want to do?
That's
like, it's huge. So,
parents, if you're listening, your kids, they're their own person. Like really, like, you know,
and if you give them that freedom, I think to ask themselves that question, be honest with themselves, that question with no shame, and then to lean into it while leaning into their strengths rather than constantly pointing out weaknesses or shortcomings, man, they're going to be happy, which is what you want for. And I feel like that's true for everybody, even not even just parents, like with your friends and stuff like that and your coworkers. It's like, we should all just be leaning into our strengths. Like if Benton's not good at fucking school as it's currently written, but he's a great actor or a great performer or a rock star, or he's just like naturally gorgeous. Any of these things have fucking value. Damn it. They do.
My mom goes the extra mile. Like for instance, this audition process I'm in right now, I was saying it's for a real person. Who I'm not sure how much I can say. He's a real person who was a murderer.
Okay.
And my mom, I found out she keeps a picture of him as her phone background, this murderer. And every time I open my phone, I see him and I just remember to pray for you that you get this, you know, like, and she's sitting at the local library with this picture of a murderer and staring lovingly at it. Probably she's like, my mom, very creative. She's a sweetheart. She's amazing. But
I love that.
I'm afraid every answer I have is gonna get really fucking long. So strap in. But to go back where we were. So she got on the computer and was like, you know, obviously Benton has interests that are not going the way that, you know, are going to be good.
Can't scrub away from him.
Yeah. So she found the Missouri Fine Arts Academy, which is an amazing program. And I know it was under attack recently. I hope it's still there. As a lot of arts in Missouri are under attack, and a lot of things in Missouri are fucking under attack.
Sure.
But this program is so amazing. And it takes a group of like 150 high school artists from Missouri, and you audition, and they bring you to an interdisciplinary college program for a summer, where they bring college faculty from all across the country to come teach interdisciplinary arts to groups of students. And you you break up into your art. So you have to apply for a certain art, music, dance, painting.
So you had some practice at this before we showed up in North Carolina.
Yes. Well, this is the magic moment, really, is I applied for guitar because that's what I was. And I get on, you know, I probably get on my audition. I don't remember what I like, played on guitar, but it was probably like the Strokes or something, you know, like, hey, da, 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 you know, whatever. And I'm not great. Let's be honest. I'm not super great, but then probably not either. But and I sent it and I didn't get accepted. And I realized, well, I don't even think I got to sending it because they had these requirements that were like, play this scale and play and go through your chord progressions and et cetera.
They wanted a classical guitarist.
I couldn't read music. I just, you know, right. My brother who had a jam band taught me how to play guitar and I right. was playing the Strokes all the time. So I applied for guitar and I realized it wasn't going to work out. And so I looked at what else they had to offer. And the only thing that I figured I could do, the only thing didn't really have requirements besides just do something
right.
was acting. Put yourself on tape and do these three things. And I was like, you know, well, I do some stuff here at, you know, with the drama program and I've always loved that. I'd probably be pretty good at that. Let me give that a shot. Cause I just had to go to this school. You know, I really wanted to go. And I applied for acting and I got in and, my acting teacher there was, Ian Merrigan. Who do you know this guy?
No.
Ian Merrigan is OG UNCSA. I forget when he graduated, but
like long, 70s?
No. I don't think so. I think okay. like Key Gerald time, probably.
Oh, okay. So maybe like early 90s.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
Got it.
Not that much older than me, but I was in high school at the time and he was an adult. But he was teaching acting there and he's NCSA. And as the listeners and you, I'm sure know, like NCSA is good. I mean, he's really great. You know, the what they teach you is the real thing, not any puff or puff or whatever. But and so he was teaching us kids the real thing, you know, and it was magical. And I remember one day we did this like improv exercise and it just like, you know, I just felt that thing. And he was like, he like took me aside. I remember he said like, this is really like, you're really good. And I think you should not do anything else. Like you should go after this. And I was like, what do you mean? Did I go stand in line for ice cream? You mean like, I literally had no idea. I had no idea that you could like, you know, go to school, that you could train, that you could, I didn't even know colleges existed for this thing. I was like, what? And he was like, yeah, you know, I went here. It was a great program. You should, you know, apply to some schools. Like, go, let's go. I think I had already been accepted to U of A for journalism at that time. Was my kind of Hail Mary to not throw my life away, you know? And
yeah.
Nah, instead, I called my mom in the dorms of Missouri Fine Arts Academy, and I just was crying, and I was just asking them for permission, you know, to do this, like. Can I take this risk? You know, I just found out you could do this. Like, let's go, you know? And of course they were like, yes, let's go. You know, there's some stipulation. You have to apply for these real colleges as well. And my mom and dad hilariously tell me later that they were like, yeah, well, we just, it's kind of tough love my parents have. The realistic love. They were just like, yeah, we just thought you wouldn't get into any of them. And then the backup, you know, you would go and get a job. But I did get into UNCSA and I think I have Ian Merrigan to thank for that and most of my life, honestly. But one day I was sitting in UNCSA in Matt Bullock's class. You know?
Yeah.
He's my, wow. But nothing more needs to be said. We know Matt Bullock. Matt Bullock is the best. But I was sitting in Matt Bullock's class and, I came into Matt Bullock's class. And I walk into the classroom and he's sitting there with Ian Merrigan. And I hadn't seen Ian Merrigan since I was in high school, like many years ago. this was like, I think my like junior or senior year in college.
Right.
And I also, I didn't really remember or know that he had gone to this school. I for some reason, it wasn't something that I thought of.
Didn't click.
But I saw him. This was just a like, what the Missouri? Like the, what? What about that? You know?
Right.
And it was just, it was awesome to see this guy who trained me. I mean, the way he trained me, it was, you know, it was, what are you doing? You know, who are you substituting? You know,
I taught at School of the Arts when they first started that acting out program for like middle schoolers and to come after school. And I got an email that Janine forwarded from me that she sent to me and Carl, which I appreciated. That was like a note from the mom. That it was basically like four levels of telephone. But basically the kid had gone home after my class and told her mom that she loved the class, and which is great, sure. But she added the detail that you just gave to Ian's work, which is it at that age, it was the first drama, theater, whatever you want to call it, experience that she had had where they didn't just play like theater games, which have a tremendous amount of value to warm people up, to get people out of their shells, to help loosen up social tensions that exist in young people. I love theater games for purposes.
Yeah.
But it's not acting. It's fucking nothing to do with it, really. It's, it's like listening to, I'm trying to think of a good comparison in music. I think it would be like if you joined a drum circle with like a bucket and you don't know how to play the drums, but you bang along with it and you're like, okay. And you're playing with the group and it gets you, hey, I'm not afraid to make music with people and shit, but you are not learning how to be a musician. That's not the same thing.
Yeah.
You're just banging on a bucket with a bunch of other people.
Yeah.
And I think it surprises some people how ready some young minds are for things like the craft of acting, which we are like, oh, you don't really need to learn that or try to learn that till you're like 18, 19. You won't be able to handle it. Even high school theater.
I think it'd be a lot like the mystery of language. Like when you're younger, like you can say, what does it feel to be honest?
Right.
And to express myself. I think there's a lot of really great kids who do that. And you can pinpoint it for sure.
But there's so much value in the actual skill set being taught, like asking a 13-year-old, like, what do you want? You're like, what?
Yeah.
Like, what do you mean? They've never even considered thinking about life as far as like, oh, you know, everybody everywhere all the time just wants things and is trying to get them from each other. And you're like, that is explosive when you're 13. That's a new kind. And some people aren't ready to think about the world like that. You're right. It's a limited language thing, a concept thing. But man, you talk to 12 kids, two or three of them are going to be like, what? You just lit my brain on fire. And now I need to think about this.
I think if you can grasp that and you can handle that, I think it prepares you for anything, the road to where I am now has not been easy. It's all been improvised. There's no one who's really, you know, thrown a rope for me necessarily, except for these great teachers and stuff. And I feel ready for anything. You know, my life is it's a trajectory. I'm gonna be living it at whatever place it is. And if I'm real broke, I'm always broke, but if I'm real broke, or real down and out or whatever, like at least I understand my place in the universe pretty well. I understand myself and I understand other people and how it works. It's so valuable. It's just so valuable. And to work through your own therapy through thinking about yourself and how other people do the same and feel the same and have the same. It's just so good. But
I think you're right. And I think that that's something that I've been kind of saying for a long time, in that I think it's funny to me that theater, which you could do with, I've been a drama teacher before. If you're a drama teacher, pretty much when you get hired, there's no curriculum usually. And it's up to you. You have to just turn something in that your principal is going to be like, I'm okay with you teaching the kids that. That makes sense to me. Go ahead. It's not history. There's no test. You can pretty much teach them whatever you want. Some high school drama teachers might be doing different shit, but I went to more than one high school. I've talked to a lot of people who did drama and theater in high school, and a lot of what we call theater class, which a lot of like, that's the one that like, you know, yeah, they're the kids who want to do the play are in it. Also the jocks who need a fucking credit are in it too. And they're like standing up there with their R Town script, like, oh, man, I can't believe she's dead. You know, and that's fine. I think that's okay. But if we're going to have that blow off class that half the kids are taking because it's, they need it, and the other half the kids are like legitimately interested in it, why not up the fucking ante of what we're talking about? Have a like Ashley Jansen style class, have a Sconey style class, something where we're really digging into like, why do people do things? Tell us a story. All right, let's pick it apart and see what everyone's motivation in that story was. Because we're studying real drama between people, how people interact, what we're doing on Earth, rather than just like, all right, scenes from a hat. You're the accountant and you're trying to get your taxes done. Be funny. And you're like, this is what we're going to do in drama class today. But it's like they're afraid to go anywhere real because they know, I don't know, maybe they I don't know what the motivations is. I don't want to guess, but I think part of it is an acceptance that half these kids aren't into it. Mm. And I think that I remember being in those classes as the nerd who was like, I'm here to learn acting and theater. And then there's the class, the kids who are blowing it off, which I don't care about the fact that they're blowing it off, but I hate the fact that it feels like the teacher is slowing down for them.
Well, I can also pinpoint my high school acting teacher as being amazing.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
This is right place, right time, truly.
Right.
She really wanted to be, what's the word when you're shaking things up? You know, subversive or something?
Sure. Yeah. She's a maverick, a little bit of a renegade.
Yeah, she wanted to be a lot because, you know, this is a Catholic high school, et cetera, et cetera. And so these kids you're talking about who are like, I don't really want to be here. Oh, she made them want to be there. Like, you know,
right.
She was really good at that. She was tough. But she was picking shows for this Catholic high school, like A Lie of the Mind.
Which Matt Bullock directed like right before you got there.
Yeah. It was one of the shows I saw when I visited the school. Just like kind of intense pieces like that is what you would usually choose. Like I said, this show about the Holocaust, like, you know, like, which in some ways, a lot of, you know, Catholic high schools have to kind of do what they have to do. They have no place telling some stories, but I really like how she went there with all of it. And, she was tough. She was cool. She really cracked the whip and like, she had like Meisner books, like in the classroom. Like she was just cool. She would take us to New York to go see plays, to go see Broadway shows.
Hell yeah.
Hilarious in itself, going to New York with a gaggle of suburban Catholic mom chaperones
right.
to go to Broadway. You know,
what did you see?
Oh God, Rob, we saw the Book of, like I said, this is my acting teacher.
You saw Book of Mormon with all those people?
With our Catholic suburban mom chaperones. And they cried and left. They were crying. I was sitting next to this chaper. She cried and she left. And when we finally, after we watched the show, and I just loved it. Oh my God, I loved it. After the show, we got out and I went, you know, we went to go find the chaperones. And she was standing outside the theater sobbing. And she kept saying, why would they say that about God? Why would they say that about God? Oh, you know, Book of Mormon, fuck God in the eye and the ass, that song.
I was hoping you would fill in the gaps for everybody. Yeah. I know.
Yeah. You're like, what? Book of Mormon?
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, that's all of that has really inspired my mission, I think, to try to be. To try to be a little irreverent. Some people just get so caught up that they hurt themselves. Like she could have watched that show and said, I don't agree with you, but I think,
who gave you that discernment, mom or dad?
About like irreverence.
just on the notion of seeing that experience. And you could have gone so many different ways with where she was at. I'm judging none of them, but just to make it clear, you could have been like, man, she sucks. She's got like no, she's got terrible attitude. Like, get her out of here. That's not you. So I know that's not how you reacted. You also have been like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. We shouldn't have brought you. This is so bad. This is our fault that you feel bad. That's not you either. There are a number of ways to do it, but your thought was like, okay, well, I'm not going to let you take away my good night. I enjoyed the show. And I kind of have compassion for the fact that you feel bad, but you had a choice to engage with that content in a different way. And maybe in the future, open your brain a little bit. You can just sit, walk out and say it wasn't for me. It doesn't have to ruin your life.
Yeah.
Where do you think that specific perspective comes from in your head? Because that is a very open-minded and healthy perspective for them and for you.
Well, my parents are both Methodists. My mom is a librarian, as I said. My dad is a lawyer. And I think if you put those two together, you get somebody who tells stories with discernment, you know?
That is a very, very good point.
I think it's it makes sense. I'm an actor. That's just like, you know, my father is very, very, he's probably the sweetest guy that
is. He a trial lawyer?
Yeah. Like he owns a firm.
Got it. Plenty of lawyers sit behind a desk and do paperwork all the time.
I think that's most of his situation. He does a lot of like contract and stuff, but he also does trial.
Got it.
But he's the sweetest. Like he's taken jobs in town for people to save them from the law, and he gets paid in construction work, you know, or
got it,
or food resources, you know, like
that was just my granddad. He was a big barterer.
Yeah, it's really he's a great guy. I think I get devil's advocate from him. I can't help but even if I'm furious about something, I instantly kind of go, well, you know, it. Like last night, I was picking up Courtney from her show on Broadway, which felt so cool. I got out of a one-on-one class, which, you know, is its own thing. Do you know what this is, one-on-one?
I think they took us to it like when the relationship with the school first started.
You pay to talk to casting directors, et cetera, to train with them. They teach you about what they want. It's a nice program. But it can feel a little bit like the waiting room of a extras cast. You know, there's a lot of desperate actors around you. And that feeling rubs off a little bit, you know, if you're ever in an audition room or if you're an extra or you're in a one-on-one, there's just, so when you're immersed in these waters of desperation,
I did background acting when I first got to LA, literally for money. I was like, I can be on set all day for this rate. Sure. I'm not doing anything. I need fucking money. Yeah. And I know how to keep my shit together enough to, what do you need me to wear? This shirt, you got it. Stand over here, no problem. You know, whatever it is, basic shit. But man, that community is so weird. It's so weird to be in, dude. I met my wife in that community, for real.
Yeah.
And she will tell you to this day, I mean, she doesn't do that anymore. And she also, and this is what we kind of connected about. We both met doing background acting and neither of us had an ambition to be an actor. Like we weren't on that track to do that. And she was doing it also for money, also kind of to pass time. She's also a hand model, but now she's a therapist. And it is so wild, that community, and she can speak to it so much better than I can, but it is such a weird mix of people. You got your randos like me and her who are like, no plan to be in the business. We don't care. We're there to just like, oh, what is it? $100? Stand over here. Thank you. A lot of paid audience shit in LA. That's one of my favorite stuff. They're like, sit here and be a good laugher. And me and my wife are like, you got it. And we would watch a free show, not even free. They give us $100 each. I'm like, this is great. But a lot of people around you are like, this is part of my journey to become a professional actor. And I also have talked on the show before. First of all, I want to make it very clear. I am not talking shit about being a background actor. If you want to be an actor, we have talked about it before. Reps will tell you, don't do it. My advice is do it.
In a way, you know,
it is better, in my opinion, to spend time on set making your money than waiting tables if the money is going to be similar. I'd rather be on a fucking set. Just don't put it on your resume.
I was background in Miss Maisel once, and Rachel Brosnahan was doing a scene with her ex-lover, and she really, like, this was maybe the first time that I got to see actually really professional actors doing it. And obviously there's you have a feeling of being separated by some invisible wall.
Yep. Your
real actors are there, you know? And the way she took command of the moment and the set and asked for her own needs and would stop to talk to the other actor and be like, you know, I'm doing this, I'm action that, situate, like,
talking the talk about
work. And I was like, that's what I do. It's like, wow, it's so good. And I mean, to be on a set, to you go for it, go do it, go be there, you know, don't wait tables.
Any way to kill that disillusionment that you have, whatever it is in your head that's making celebrities or TV or film or acting on a pedestal for you, to where you're down here and it's up here, and one day I'm gonna get, you need to get up here with it, bring it down, bring you up, get on the same page, or you're gonna be stuck in a weird position. And being on set for anything will help.
Talking about that separation, where the story I was on just a minute ago, mm-hmm. I got a one-on-one class, I felt this certain type of way.
Right.
I also am in this audition process that's like the craziest moment of my life. Like, I've gotten really far. And it's really big. And my mind's just all over the place about that. I definitely feel like in two worlds, you know, kind of right now. And I just produced this movie, and like Tabitha King's executive producing, and it's coming out this fall. And it's just like a lot going on. It feels so good. And I really feel like I'm coming into my skin. And
congratulations.
Thanks. Yeah. So I got out of this class and I went to go pick up my girlfriend who, is UNCSA's most beautiful graduate, Courtney Carter. You probably know she's most talented. She's amazing.
Of course.
She's on Broadway right now. I went to go pick her up, and I just had this mix in my head of, like, you know, being the student at a pay to play and also being on the line for something huge. And it's this weird mix. And I went to go stand to wait for her, and the security guard just bodies me. You know what I mean? I was like, whoa, you know? And I was just, you know, to go way back to my dad.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The moment I was like ready to scrap, you know, and then I'm like, wait, right. Like, if, you know, my girlfriend's in there, and if somebody crazy came to, you know, I'm glad.
You would want him to do exactly that.
Yeah. And I was like, this is good. I just can't seem to find the worst in anybody. I don't know. Courtney gets so annoyed when I'm like, yeah, but maybe they just, you know, they're feeling kind of, I don't know. I think it's my mission to explore.
I attract people like that, like crazy, dude. I think that's why I love you so much. My favorite people are in the world that are like my best friends, Brandon Harris, Wiley, my roommate, Kyle, my wife, all these people they do exactly that. They have got a fucking excuse for every shitty behavior of another person. Cause they work. They don't even have to work. They just occurs to them. And it balances me out so much, to the point that now I actually think I have, like, I'm never going to be like all these people I just named to mention, but I have joined the thought process in a very deep way of, you don't know what they're going through. You never know someone's experience. I hold that close. And I think it's why I've worked so hard in my life to collect you folks as people that I care about. Because it's important.
There's people who can be very happy living their own life by their own standards. And there's people who can only be happy if you live their life by their standards. And right. I can't fucking stand those people. I can't stand MAGA. It's all wrong with this world. There's just an easy perspective shift to say, I'm me. I'm cool with that. And if you don't hurt me or anybody, then, like, do what you want to do. And, you know, I just can't stand it's tale as old as time, racism, ignorance, misunderstanding, et cetera, whatever. But if there's just more people who go, you know, I'm myself, I'm happy with myself, and see themselves in other people. And this is why I think the arts is a valuable thing that shouldn't be delegislated, as hard as it is. But, it helps the world.
Do you think it would be a tough thing for you and Courtney to live in Ellsbury together?
I love Aylesbury.
Me too. Just from everything you've said.
Of course. What is it? You can't go get a sandwich and play pinball at 4 a.m. at the same time. New York is New York. New York's New York for me. I mean, although New York does sleep, it's not the city that never sleeps. All the good restaurants close at 10 for the most part, et cetera. You know, but of course, no, I can't. Once you live in a big city like this, you can't really go back. Although my dream, not Aylesbury, but I'm going to have a farm, you know, one day. That's my goal. I'm going to raise my kids on it. I'm going to raise little me's the way that my parents did. You know what I mean? That's sort of really what I want to do. And it's a mark of success for me to have land somewhere that's outside of a city, for sure.
Mm.
Aylesbury is very isolated. Best place for me to grow up. But, you know, it's like that musical your friend wrote from Missouri. You got to get out. You just got to get out if you want to do things.
I think that's part of it. And I feel the same way about the opportunity and the things that I want to be able to do. But I think also in my mind, personally, I don't think I could ever move back to the place where my farm is, because not that I'm not equipped to deal with it, not that I wouldn't deal with it if I had to, but I don't think I'm interested in the additional stress that would come with being in an interracial marriage in that part of the country. I don't want to do it. Like, I'll fight the fight when it comes to me, but I'd rather live where people let me fucking live and I don't have to feel like I'm in defense of anything.
Be a very different answer if you ask Courtney that, I think. And you know, do better, Missouri. Jesus fucking Christ. Like, it's hard for us to go and see my family. Like, no joke. Not my family personally.
Not your immediate family.
None of my family has problems with that I know. But to go and to travel there, honestly, there's and it's not like it's hard to travel there if you're a minority.
Is it an existential anxiety, or do you encounter things?
No, it's something that infuriates ignorant people about love happening between two people.
Right.
It's kind of like I don't know. I think people really subconsciously don't understand why they're racist. And when they see that, it's this, you know, it looks like that should right. happen. No, I mean, I don't know. I can't really get behind what goes on in their brain, but.
I mean, honestly, if they've been listening so far, you know, I'm not taking this position, but it's not hard for me to understand where they're coming from. I don't agree with it, but the logic's not impossible for me to wrap my brain around. And I can't speak for specific people, but I can definitely speak to situations and conversations I've had with my family. I mean, I grew up when my parents got divorced, my mom married a Mexican guy within a couple of years and was married to him for like 20 years. And before that, my whole family is all white, head to toe, every corner of it. Like, nobody was everybody was white. And my mom married this Mexican guy, and he had three Mexican kids that he had with another Mexican woman. So they're all full Latino and Latina. And it's, for me, it was an early introduction to that dynamic. But I think that what's going on in their head is something that is the same thing that happens to people like the woman crying outside of Book of Mormon. I think that there is
what you're taught.
It's what you're taught, but you're taught it. Okay. Well, you can grow up and learn a new thing, but the thing that keeps that from happening is a fear of loss. You're worried that you're going to lose this thing that you can't even really define or nail down or be specific about, but you know,
privilege.
You know, part of it is they need to kind of be over there and this needs to be over there. And we need to keep those things separate, because what makes this great is that it's itself. So we don't want to challenge that by introducing any new elements. Let's not let the melting pot melt too fucking much.
Like I said, those are the people who say you can't live your life unless it's serving mine.
Exactly. Because they think it, one of my favorite phrases of all time, I say favorite because it's hilarious to me, not because I agree with it, is when gay people get married, it ruins marriage for heterosexual people. They used to say that a lot in the 90s. And I was like, how? Like now you've lost me. A minute ago, I kind of was like, well, if you keep them separate, you get, I can start to understand the logic, though you're wrong.
What is the value in it? I'm not a religious person, but I love Jesus. I think Jesus was super dope.
Hey, hell of a person to study.
If people would listen to Jesus, instead of the Bible or their pastor,
you
actually really learn a lot about human compassion that helps you be a better person.
It's all built in, actually. Yeah. And yeah. I think my wife and I are just talking about that because she's watching that Hillsong documentary. And she grew up very deep in the very conservative Korean church and has since left the church, but has not like abandoned her beliefs or religion. She just has issues with institutions. And she and I talk about this all the time because we're both raised Christian and we both left the church and we both still believe in the core tenets of Christ. Like, aside from all of the supernatural elements of the religion of like repentance and heaven and hell, we're not necessarily sold on all that, but like pick up your brother, the weak and the needy, compassion. Like, we're all in this together. We're all brothers and sisters. Like, that hit, it landed, and we don't need to go remind ourselves every week. We don't need to read a book every week. We don't need to.
You certainly don't need to hate the gays. Do you? I mean, do you?
And their marriages aren't ruining ours. It's so crazy.
I just don't get it. I really see a distinction in people. And like, that's the only way I've really been able to pinpoint it is like, I can live my life on, you know, within my own self. And if you aren't hurting anyone or myself, then live yours. And then there's the people who say that you can't live your life unless it serves the thing I'm on. It just doesn't make. And at the end of the day, that is it. Like, you can't
say impact is what matters. How much do we affect each other? Because I agree. Someone can go scream racist stuff about Asian people into a pillow in their own room. And I'm not going to lie, I don't really care about that. They can say it about white people. It's not in my business. Do I think that's like helpful? No, but that's your right. Whatever. You say it in front of me and my wife or me alone, we're going to have a fucking problem. But before that, before it hurts other people, before you do that, man, live your fucking, just leave it. Just leave me alone.
I mean, I'll take you deeper. And I think there's a part of me that's sort of like a hopeless culture warrior. Yeah, as Matt Van Gessel, he'll definitely tell you that. But, you know, I just want to be out there. But I think one thing about that is like, that's where it's the source is really the key for a lot of ignorance. Like,
sure.
And the unseen things, you can go out and you can say racist things to someone's face and they can say, fuck you. And that's his own thing. But the person who's screaming racist things into their pillow, they probably go out and they do racist things. Maybe you don't see. Maybe they vote a certain way. Maybe they watch. They promote a certain sort of media. Maybe they, you know.
It's unlikely that that's the only racist thing they're doing.
Yeah. So I also have problems with the person who would scream into their pillow. But
act of the pillow screaming, if by chance you're channeling it all into that, I support it because I'd rather you do that harmless thing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But
I don't know how much I can affect what's hardwired into you at the end of the day. And so that's why I'm saying like, this is why I bring that up as an example. I'm not saying I have no problem at all with the fact that that's happening. Like, in my soul, does it hurt a little bit? Sure. But at the end of the day, I feel like there's only so much we can do to affect other people, like you said, that don't agree with us. And they're not going to self-deport from living next door to us. They're not leaving. We got to fucking get up and buy cakes from them and shit. Like, you know, it's we all have to figure out a way to do it. And so it's like,
yeah,
I want to leave people a little bit of room to, if you want to be the worst version of yourself in private, and that's your way of getting it out, I'm not going to hunt you down for that. I'm not going to make you feel ashamed about what you do in the dark or what you scream into a pillow. But I am going to point out the distinction that doesn't cause anyone any hurt there. Mm. And if you do it all there, or whatever that place is for you, now you start inviting people to scream together into the same pillow. Now we have a club forming. Now we have a fucking problem. Like, this is when it gets out of hand. But I think what it feels like lately is like, even if you have a thought that doesn't agree with the world, or you have a thing that everyone's not on the same page with, or you're not on the same page with everybody else, it starts to be that kind of Catholic mind crime shit where you're like, the fact that you're even thinking that, fuck you. And that's, that is not helping people come to the table on any of the shit.
Right. Yeah. There's gotta be, you know, part of what makes people that way is just a desire to be oppositional. But yeah, I mean, stuff, it's like my whole actor mission, honestly, is sort of why I like, you know, I want to do this. I want to buy a house for my parents and stuff too. You know, I want to do all that. But I also, I've lost a lot of
friends. Isn't your brother a lawyer?
Yeah, 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 he'll do it.
Don't worry about it, man. Go have fun.
Yeah, so I'm no stress really, but part of why I really want to do it, like I've lost a lot of friends since from when I grew up, solely just from going to a big city, being in the arts and having a liberal mindset.
Yep.
And it's come out to things like I've, you know, said, hey, like maybe, like there's this movie with Cuties, right? Which is mess. It was like, had a lot of Netflix.
That's the one with the kids stripping or some shit.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that's the way you perceive it. It was written by a woman, who she was sharing her own experience, you know,
got it.
And it did get twisted. It's like pretty, there's like,
I never saw it. That's what I picked up from the headlines.
Pedophilic stuff for sure. That's kind of the way it was marketed, you know, but at the core, this is it was a female writer director who was telling her story. And I just remember the world was blaring about it. Like, you know, look, Hollywood pedophilia, you know,
right. They want to tie those things together.
Right. So yeah. You know, which is like, it's not like it doesn't happen, like Jesus, but, you know, I kind of, and I just keep finding myself in this place there. I'm just, it's the wrong argument, man. And I kind of am like, I was like to this guy, he was ex-military, he's Marine boxing champion for a while. I love this guy. We used to go down to parties at the river. And we would do this thing where I would pretend to get punched by him. He's huge, Marine boxing champion. And he would do a across the face and I would do a bop, you know? And we would get money betting these drunk people, how many times can he punch me in the face before I knock out? I love him. This is so good. Like, this is my friend, you know?
That's a good hustle.
And he said it was great. It was a good idea, actually. I'm kind of a skinny guy who's
and great hustle.
I could get a really good kick.
Ugh. Oh yeah. Oh, I'm sure you sold the shit out of
almost
it.
Almost go down. Everyone, oh yeah. You know, yeah. Next he's down, you know.
So you're practicing acting. You're both making mad money.
I love this guy. And then he had said something about how you know the left is coming for my kids, and I kind of was like, I don't think it's that extreme. You should watch the movie. It's a bad thing to say, and I was like, you should watch it. And it was written by a woman, and I think she's sharing her perspective, and I think it's worth giving a chance to, maybe, you know. I think
every piece of art is like that,
and that's not a typical, I wouldn't say, Midwestern mindset. And the response was, I didn't know you're a pedophile, Benton. And
wow,
I can't find him anymore,
right?
It's just amazing. So
what was your processing of that since then? What do you think about that?
I mean, it's happened in a lot of different ways. It's happened for a lot of people, especially I think during the pandemic and you know, the Trump era. And it's this very divisive time, and it's very easy to get on the internet and get a perspective that you want to die on the hill for. It's really hard. I always have dreamed that I'll go back and I'll premiere a movie at the local theater and it'll be awesome. And I'll bring people to the town and it'll be nice. And then there's a
Mr.
certain
Senate will make the speech.
Yeah.
There's hometown boys back.
Yeah, let's go. There's a certain warfare against artists though, you know, just throw them in the basket with the Satanists and pedophiles. And there's a lot of hard lines there, you know, which of course, like if you think that I might be coming for your kids,
why wouldn't you protect them?
What else? What kind of other motivation is there? But a lot of my friends have kind of come to me. We're done. And I don't really feel like I've ever done anything. I certainly, I don't promote pedophilia or sucking the blood out of children and drinking it, or like,
don't knock it till you've tried it.
Oh my god. Yeah, here, this is the thing that's gonna ruin my career, I guess. But yeah, and I mean that's part of my whole mission with irreverence, et cetera. I think it hurts people. I think it breaks people up. I mean, there's no reason he couldn't say no, like, I'm not watching that, but like,
right,
okay, you know, that makes it a little different that she was a woman and blah, 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 et cetera, and whatever.
Honestly, Benton, I can't relate to that more. I've had a lot of that in my family. I've had a lot of that in my friends. But you know what's crazy? Is for years, like when Obama was president, I started seeing it happening, right? A little bit here and there. It'd be people on my family. And I was like, whoa, I didn't, like, that's loud. That's loud and that's angry. And I don't ever remember you being like this. Like, that's so crazy. And I've been dealing with it slowly and slowly. But what's really broken my fucking heart, if I'm being really candid, is the experiences I've had, just like the one you described, but with people on the left, the people I thought we wanted the same shit. And I'm like, you sound like them. You're condemning. Oh, this person used the wrong word, or they spoke about a thing the way I don't like it, or you know, and it's like this, all of a sudden, it felt like there was this rising tide of liberalism, of like, we're making all these accomplishments. And as soon as we got any power, it's like everyone started to try to tear each other to pieces. And everybody who wanted to accomplish these things that we all want to accomplish started to pick apart their allies because they weren't, you know, letting the perfect be the enemy of the good. Well, and even
saying allies, it's like a, you know, I don't know. We're all people, like,
right. But allies to the causes they want to accomplish.
Right. Right. Yeah. Of course.
Yeah. Specifically. I'm not trying to make teams out of it, but I understand. You're right. That's maybe not helpful language.
No, but that's how we all, I think that's how we all are, you know, at least, being pushed to feel. You know?
No, you're right. Very much. Like it's divisive. And I think that's the thing that drives me crazy is I'm like, I actually sometimes have more sympathy for people who are on the right or in the middle of whatever this current moment is, because at least they're moderately like not shouting people down. And maybe they're like, look, I just don't want anything to happen to my kids because they watch the same news channel, but they're not hateful. They're loving, kind people. They just don't have the right information. And I'm trying to like grease some wheels with those people, bring them into the, cause they really do want the best for everybody and all that shit. Yeah. And then I feel like there's people who are on my side, and especially as a guy who lives in LA and works in Hollywood, man, dude, how do you think people in Texas feel about me? Just same as Ellsbury feels about you. It's like this fucking commie pedophile kid moved out to this place. And I'm like, first of all, I'm too center for LA. I'm too left for my hometown. So I'm not really from any side at this point. But what I do know is I want the same things as a lot of people who are not willing to, like you say, appreciate nuance, irreverence,
I want to bridge the gap so hard.
Me too.
I mean, like I said, is who do you want to be? Do you want to be somebody who can live with your own happiness, or do you want to be someone who needs others to conform to your own? It's just such a evil thing. But America, let's go.
all we can do is, I think, do by example, because at this point I think, and this is the thing that's being missed on that, you want to bridge the gap, I want to bridge the gap, we want to do that. Really, the best way to do it is to just keep doing what we are doing, living the way that we are living, with compassion and reason and thought and nuance and reverence, all these things we've talked about in this whole conversation, and to mention it politely anytime it's appropriate. And that's like all you can fucking do, because what everyone else is getting wrong is thinking that they're going to accomplish their goals by shouting down the people who agree.
This is the, you know, talking about an actor's podcast. This is exactly the kind of thing I think everybody, you should really be motivated. I mean, everybody knows this, but not by, you know, the the series regular or the lead or the Oscar or whatever, but it's like, you know, I think we have an important thing to do and you should find your thing to do. It'll stick you to it. I mean, I don't think I can rest without, you know, having a, like a, I don't know, being in an interracial couple on a Fast Five movie or something, you know, like I want butts in seats who need to learn something. Like that's, yeah. That doesn't really happen. You know, unless you're a chaperone, Catholic suburban high school mom watching,
Book of Mormon,
you know, and look what it did. I mean, maybe it was negative for her. I don't really know. But I mean, like, that's the first earthquake to make you go, why am I in pain? You know? I think it's so essential. And I think having that kind of purpose is really, really freeing. I mean, I think when I graduated, I was mostly going for success, you know?
Whatever your 22-year-old brain thought that was.
Yeah. But having, you know, having a reason for your artistry, it just changes. It changes everything. Like now I think so many people really need to shift their perspective on what they're doing. I graduated and I was freelancing with a lot of top five agencies and I just felt so good. I just felt like, let's go, we're done. It's sealed up. You know, it's cocky and wasn't thinking about a purpose. The pandemic happened sometime later and amazing perspective shift. That's so freeing. Like, I started to look at the people next to me and like, what are they doing and how can we do something together? And more so, how can I make stuff on my own? I think when you start to think about that, the sky's the limit, really, for anybody. You know, I took a look at the ropes that were sort of holding me back and cut some things and go, okay, like what happens if I just do the things that I think my successful self would do? And so start writing the stories that you think are good. And then suddenly you kind of like, these are good, you know, and it becomes more passionate. And I just produced a film with a dear friend of mine from UNCSA, Andrew Rakich. I mean, man, I don't want to go back to anything besides making indies. Like, I mean, I'm going to, but, amount of control you have over that, over what you're saying, it's just unparalleled. So good.
I have to say, man, and I don't say this to everybody on this show, not because it's not true, but because it doesn't always just occur to me in big neon letters, but it does. And so I want to say it to you. I said it to, I think last time I thought about this was with Lauren Kerriman. I'm really glad that you are doing the work you're doing, because I'm really in love with the reasons you're doing it. And I don't just mean that as an actor, you know, I mean that as a person. And that's subjective. It's valueless. It's just a thing that I'm saying because it's true for me. It's not anything to measure anything on. But when I hear some people talk about their work, you know, I like some reasons better than others. Like I said, they're not better or worse, but I just like it. I like why you're doing it, because it seems to be, to me, productive for more than just yourself. And I appreciate the shit out of that. Yeah.
What else do you do? Yeah. And I mean, that's a lot of, there's some pressure there, you know, that you feel to do stuff and to actually be something.
But it's okay if you don't either, because your value to me is also not assigned to your acting, which is why I also just made it clear, and I'll say it one more time. I'm not just talking about your art. I'm talking about you. Like, you being a person, the way that you treat Courtney, the way that you are with your friends, the way that you encounter that lady outside Book of Mormon. Like, I mean it. I want more of that. My wife would be like, oh my God, she's upset. That needs to exist in the world too. Great. But I feel like there's a lot of that. And there's not quite enough of compassion and yet objectivity, fairness.
Particularly for the arts. This is why it enrages me so much too. Like, I'm probably going to blacklist myself with some producers by saying, taking a successful television show or movie and making it into a musical is one of the worst things you can do for the world.
Why do you think that? No, I tend to agree, but it's not an area I've spent a lot of time. Why do you think that?
Because there's so many, you know, you say you dig my perspective and my effort. There's so many of me, as you know, who are doing that, who want that, or who have a real story to tell. There's so many writers and artists who are going without being able to say anything, and people need to go learn here, right? I mean, I don't mean to be like a hoity-toity, you know, go and have fun and watch Cocaine Bear too. It's great. Fun, great.
Sure.
I don't know what it does for anyone, but it doesn't have to.
Every now and then we get Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Yes. Yeah. And like, yeah, like, fuck yes. You still need to tell the same stories all the time. You gotta do more, but yeah, just like that. And it's the same with famous actors. I feel like we really don't need more of the same person's story or perspective over and over and over and over and over again. Particularly, I feel like when that person has become rich and, you know, everybody.
But here's the problem with that. And I'm with you like 90%. But here, let me make this clear. This is something that comes up a lot. Not as much as it should on this podcast, but when I talk to artists and when I talk to people about how this works, as someone who started in theater, went to art school, obsessed with art, love art, value it so much, have been working in corporate television since I left school. There is what is good and right for art, and there is business, and they are often at odds with each other, because best thing for this is not a great idea for this. It's scary. It's risky. It's huge. I think we need a remodeling of using some of the shit that fucking we know we can rely on. Fast 9, Fast 10, Fast 35. Okay. Make the Marvel. I like a good Marvel movie, man. Let's fucking make them. Let's go. But let's use a little more of that capital to make Everything Everywhere All at Once. Let's make more of those things while doing the other thing. Because here's the problem. As much as you're right, we're like, God damn, man, can we make a movie that doesn't have these 30 actors in them? They get every fucking role. They've had every role. But here's the thing. When you put a poster in Ellsbury, Missouri, outside the theater with your face on it, unless your family and friends walk by it, they're like, I've never heard of that. I got something else to do tonight. Matthew McConaughey's fucking face sells that movie. He's got to be on the cover. Somebody's got to be. Somebody has to give you a reason, because you're right, Benton. Man, there's so many stories to be told, but they also make a lot of movies, and there's so many TV shows, and there's like, hey, have you seen Succession? Have you seen Barry? Have you seen Ted Lasso? Have you seen, they're all ending at once. Have you seen him? Have you seen him? Have you seen him? And no one's seen everything. They have to have a reason to give it a shot. And there's only so many reasons. There's everyone saying it's really good. It has my favorite person in it. I saw them in that other thing and I liked it. And that cachet that an actor builds is almost as fucking important as their skill set as an actor, because you got to get people in the fucking seats to see that you're great. And that's part of it. And that's what sucks and is beautiful and tragic, and why we're seeing strikes, all of this stuff, because that balance of making a good thing with good people who have good stories and sharing that with the world is so important. But you got to pay the fucking bills. And if all we ever do is cast exactly the right ethnic group for the part, or always do exactly that thing that we're like, that is important. That is fucking important. But we also need to sell it. And if we don't sell it, we're going to go out of business.
You're never going to have a perfect world. And money is such a great motivator. I don't think a good one, but
But it's the reason why America is the country you want to be an actor in, because there's more work.
I also think when you say paying, you got to pay the bills. Well, some of those bills are yachts and trips to Dubai for the producers. And
100% and studio execs. That's the balance.
At the moment, it's been really being dealt with right now is there's too much up there.
Yeah.
Can we back down here a little bit?
And it's every institution, man. It's every institution on earth is that way. The church gets too big and he's got a private jet. The fucking, you know?
In a perfect world, blockbusters would be entirely unknowns, just ready to tell their amazing story, and there'd be no war. And, you know,
but you want to do both. And Benton, this is what I'm saying about your perspective. Well, I think it's valuable, whether you make art or you move to the farm and raise your babies. The fact that you are, or do both, God bless. If you're out there living life this way, it is valuable to me as someone who shares your perspective, because I think you are interested in trying to find that balance and you recognize that it's there. There's too many people who are like, I got time for art, man. I got a yacht to buy. For real, that's how they feel. And there's a lot of people who are like, I don't care if the person in the movie is famous. That person doesn't share the identity of that character, and I don't want to see him playing the role. And it's like, okay, well, then we'll make the movie for you and your friends to watch, and you can approve of it. And to every degree, you know, it's like there's too many people who are not willing to have the negotiation conversation, the nuance, and you are.
I love it. I love what we're saying on that. I was just thinking, I was very ADD. I was thinking all the way back to the beginning of the podcast.
Oh, perfect. Bookend it, because we're almost out of time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, wow. Oh, man. We just started.
I know.
I was thinking about how we met. And
I don't remember how we met.
Well, generally doing hopscotch.
Oh, how we got to know each other.
Yeah. So, I mean, you could talk about this, Benton. I mean, there's very different stages of me throughout my life, coming from a farm, being on a farm, to living in the city. But I came to UNCSA, and somehow I got accepted. This is crazy to me that I don't know how. Well, I do know how I got accepted. You know, I see the Bob's reasoning. I love that process, too. In my day, when you auditioned for NCSA, you saw the Bob's. My dad and I drove through a blizzard to Chicago, furious at me because I was literally picking a scene on my way out of a Edward Albee book, which you're on top of right now. Oh, wow. Yeah. You're being held up by the Edward Albee book.
Thank God.
And so I was kind of picking my scene there. I went and I did the thing for the Bob's. Went to school. Oh my God. Like, this is huge. This is what? And it's all artists. And I didn't really know that was a thing at the time. And this first year. And of course, there's the directing projects, which are a big deal. Usually it's, you know, upperclassmen and upperclassmen, like upperclassmen directors, upperclassmen actors. And
usually it's the class of actors below the director. So like the fourth years will direct third year actors, and the third year's second. Yeah.
And I remember you just asked me, you were like, you want to audition for this part? And of course I'm like, yes. But I felt very proud, super proud of myself to get in there with you. You're my first big director to give me a shot. You know what I mean? And
literally a student.
Yeah, well, you were a big director to me. You still are, you know, but at that time, especially, you were the biggest director I'd ever been chosen by, for sure. By far.
I'll take it. I'll take it.
But, and we did this show, like you said, with L.A. Barone, who was, and probably still is, my favorite actress from NCSA. It's just amazing.
Hard to beat.
Yeah. And we did the show. I shaved my head for it. I went to the gym. It was, and I did it and I felt like I was flying, and everybody was like, you did so amazing. And I remember feeling ready to take on Mount Olympus here, this Hogwarts, you know.
Yeah,
I very felt some imposter syndrome, and then I was like, you know what, actually I'm not just saying lines, like I'm actually like an actor. It felt so good.
Do you know why I cast you in that?
No.
I'll tell you. That, I hate that play. I'm going to start there.
It's very,
I didn't hate it when I picked it. I didn't hate it when I was working on it.
I think it was a very student project. It's highly emotional. Stuff that we've never experienced.
It's, you know? Well, like most plays you're working on in undergrad, the characters are like too old for you, and you're supposed to be dealing with shit you haven't even begun to understand. But, and that was a factor in this, for sure. For background, so it's a little bit clearer without going into great detail, it is an Israel Horowitz play. And it is a short play.
I thought there's other people here for a second.
Right?
Yeah, it's like, yeah, I know it is, Rob.
Oh, right. We're on a podcast, of course.
Yeah.
Hello. But it's an Israel Horowitz play. It's a one act play. And a lot of times with the directing scenes, people will pick a piece of a play or something. I picked a thing that was onto itself, the beginning and end of it. I did that. We did that part because there's no more to it. And it is a play about two people who were in love when they were younger. One of them leaves their hometown and one of them doesn't. And they meet up again later and they speak in code almost to each other. The play is very hard to understand because it's all inside jokes and references that you either have to look up or make up. And so the communication is very indirect. That's part of why, as I explained this, why I cast you. You and Ellie Barone, who has been on the show before, as we mentioned, anyone who hasn't listened to her episode should. The two of you, in my opinion, at the time, were more captivating and engaged in nonverbal acting than a lot of other people I was watching. When you two just looked at each other, there was something happening. There was a lot. And because the language in that play is confusing and weird, and even the audience is like, what the fuck are they talking about for half the fucking scene? You need to know what they're saying to each other. And you two were instantly great at that. Ellie's more like this than you are. But neither of you are super like overly expressive with your face. You know, you're not making fucking character mask faces the whole time. That's not what I mean. But just by staring at each other and being in a moment, being in an emotion, it didn't seem to be a lot of work for either one of you to do that with each other. And you didn't even know each other that well.
Yeah, I can't wait to work with Ellie again.
Me too. I said that to her when she was on the show. And I can't wait to work with you because you're still one of my favorite actors for this reason also.
Hopefully I'm coming to LA soon.
That would be great. Please let me know.
Yeah.
But there, I hate the play because at the end of the day, I'm like, it was a good exercise, but I would never want to go see it or do it again because I'm like, it's not fun. It feels like you're watching a conversation that you're not part of. Sure, and then by the end, you kind of figure it out and the lights go off and you're like, what the fuck was that? Like it felt like a writing exercise for Israel or something. I don't know what it was.
No good.
But it's loaded with Paul Simon references. That's part of why I liked it too. So, but watching you two in that, was definitely one of my favorite experiences at school because it was so great to have both of you, man, that's all, probably also why I cast you two. You both speak to me so glowingly, like beyond what I feel like I deserve. And other actors who are more fairly like, oh yeah, man, that sounds great. When I talk to you and Ellie, you're like, that would be amazing. I'm so excited. And I'm like, okay, calm down, but keep going. All right. It feels great. So it's a little bit of that too, for sure. But that happened in the rehearsal room too, because when I was like, let's talk about something, let's try something, let's experiment. I direct in weird experiments. I'm like, I don't know. Let's try this today. That enthusiasm and engagement was there in a non-cynical, open, eager way that I've only found in so many people in my whole life that really work that way. And
you and Ellie imprinted on me at that time. I mean, I I remember being like, this is what we're here. This is what it is. Now this is what we're here. And then the rest is 4 years of NCSA where they really tell you what to do, you know? Right. I mean, in my time, maybe except how to get an audition and an agent and join the business.
Like start your acting career.
Yeah, but
you ask for too much.
How to be an artist was there in flowers. Like, oh my God. I think I've heard, I know sometimes you talk about the management and stuff as well. I think it's like going in a more direction of business, and which is good. But yeah, I remember I was in my fourth year, to go all the way back to the beginning. It was later in my time there. And I was having a really hard time in the middle of at the end of school. I was on arts probation like the whole time. And I was on mad arts probation. I was a different person in college, and I still think I worked really hard, but I think I also give off this persona that I'm here to party or something, you know what I mean? And I was, of course I was. I mean, yeah, we had some great parties.
but
there was that. And I think people underestimated my dedication a lot for that. And I was struggling with that so much. Senior year came, we get, I think this is a forming moment of my life. So hard. Senior year comes and you get your fourth year plays and your fourth year casting. I feel like for an NCSA student, that's what you look forward to since the day you arrive.
It's way too big of a fucking deal.
Yeah.
Like you hold it up high.
I mean, well, it's the product of what you've done for 4 years. Let's see it put to work. It's really huge.
I got to pick my final show. You guys don't get to pick shit.
No. Yeah. And case in point, I was doing a play in Winston-Salem with the children's theater with John Bowers.
Mm-hmm. With Peppercorn?
Yeah, Peppercorn. And I get I think Kira was there with me, and she was like, oh my God, we got our senior casting. It's here. You know, this was in the summer.
Of course.
And I just was like, oh, cool. I was like, let's check. Let's take a look, you know? But Kira, of course, my favorite cheerleader, she was like, let me find it for you. I want to tell you what you are, you know, scroll on her phone, scroll.
The longest scroll of your whole life.
Scrolls back up. She's like, I'm just not seeing it. But you could look it up, you know? And so I was like, oh, all right, let's see it. And I look it up. It's a list of all the casts, you know, and stuff. And I'm scrolling like for my name, but I'm just not there. I go back up. It's not there. I wasn't cast at all. My name just was not on the list. And every part was cast for the whole season. Some exciting stuff. And I just remember thinking in that moment, just being so confused. And then I started getting a flood of texts from my class. Why didn't you tell us you're not coming back?
Wow.
Like, what happened? How are you? Are you okay? You know?
Yeah.
And I didn't know. I was like, I'm waiting for my
cat. I'm finding out with you.
I thought, here's the end of the road. Like, they're kicking me out, I guess. You know?
Right.
God. I was like, ugh. And they ended up, Bob Sconi, one of my favorite people of all time, was like, I'll put him in my show, double cast, as the lead fop in this restoration era play. Perfect part for me in the end, really. But I had this moment where I've been struggling, trying to impress, trying to get out of probation, trying just to be what, you know, they wanted me to be. And I didn't get cast, and love Bob. He was stood up and he was like, I'm going to put him in my show. But I had this sense of like, fuck all that, you know? If you don't believe in me, you know, enough. Everyone approves that list. That was the hardest part. It's like all of your, you know how much you love your teachers. And I still love them, and I know they love me. But they're like your family, you know? And they're like your guardian angels. And then they all, it's like a firing squad. They all read the list.
It's like when they pick, they call the soccer team and you're left standing there by yourself, but there's like four or five different coaches and none of them picked you for the team.
But they hadn't decided to not cast me. They had, even worse, they had all gone over the list and not noticed that I wasn't cast. You know what I mean? Which is kind of like, wow. And you go,
God damn, bro.
I just felt like the worst actor in the world, honestly. And you know, a lot of my work had maybe been forced at that time. Like I said, I was under pressure. I wanted to be what they wanted me to be, you know? And so I went into this play just like, fuck everyone.
Yeah.
Fuck it all. And I did everything that I wanted to do with this play, I think to the annoyance of a lot of people. But I was
playing. Was it other like third years in the play?
I think it was almost entirely senior. It was directed.
Oh, so it was with your class.
Yeah.
They just end up double casting you with who?
Alex Bodine played.
Cut it.
Played Teresa Tan. And he and I, as you know, could almost not be more different as actors. And so we had a fire.
A vague memory of this, yeah.
We had a fire and ice fop in this play. It depended what night you would go there. It was a very different show. But I just was having the time of my life. I was like, what do I want to do? You know? And then, of course, what does Bob want to do? Master of Restoration era comedy. And I just was like, what do I want? And it's so freeing. To suddenly be like, I'm going to make my own choices. I'm going to make the boldest ones. I'm going to do what I want to do. I really feel like I wish more students could come into their own on that. But I mean, I was making crazy choices and et cetera. I had a pause in there, which is a Benton Guinness thing. If you don't know my work, I love to find a really long pause in comedy. Throw everybody for a loop, you know.
Remember, break the timing.
Yeah, and it kind of every night it got longer, but it worked. I'd had that moment. I was feeling all that way. And I did the show, and I felt like it was such a triumph. And they gave us a undershirt to wear under all of our, you know, finery. And one night I took my undershirt off. And I, you know, was folding it up into our little basket thing. And I see that there's writing on the name tag of the shirt. And I mean, I was so emotional in this whole time because I felt like my career was done, you know,
right.
Career in college. And then I also felt like I had found myself. and I looked at there was writing on the tag of the shirt and I looked at it and it said, I, Merrigan, Ian Merrigan.
Yeah. No fucking way.
Yeah, and I was wearing a shirt and just like, you know, I just was like,
man.
Like people will try to tell you to give up. And if they don't tell you to try to give up, they'll try to make you give up, or the world will, you know what I mean? But it's like keeping that dream alive can pay off at any moment. And
in ways you don't expect, yeah.
And what's not important is who you impress, but what's important is like the story you write of your own life, you know, and the people you meet and the impressions you have, was huge to me. And a revelation I'm having as well now, so many years later, talking about young Benton running around on a farm and having a dream to school, to now, to pandemic, to everything, I think I can say, testing for a lead on a Netflix series, and all kinds of other stuff. I just worked on this other thing. I can't really talk about either. The film is premiering this fall. It's like sometimes it just happens all at once, and you have to be happy with being yourself in your own journey and keep it alive. I mean, at any time it could happen. It doesn't matter if you go broke for 5 years, like just keep it alive, you know?
Proud of you, kid.
Let's go.
I am 100% in more ways. Yeah. In more ways than I can probably articulate. Thank you. This went way too long. I don't care. I love talking to you, man. No, fuck no. I'm not doing that. they can all listen to the whole 2 hours. Fuck them. No, I love you, and we'll have you back on, and we'll talk about a million other things some other time.
Yeah, let's go. Let's go.
Thanks for the time, bud.
Great. Yeah. Love you, Rob. I can't wait to ride around in a Corvette with you in LA again.
100%. It's going to be great.
All right. Peace. Take care.